Our next speaker was born in, I'm not sure whether he was born in Chicago, but he was certainly raised in my hometown here, near Chicago. I first met him when his father was out in California in the 50s. He is a distinguished Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Harvard. And while he was there, he was in the intellectual action movement of that time. In fact, perhaps he was one of the first to introduce Harvard to something more than the usual liberal assortment of ideas. He started the Harvard Society of Individualists, which later became camouflaged as the Charles River Literary Society. And I understand that's now defunct, although I thought somebody was trying to resurrect it recently, or at least resurrect the journal associated with it. Our speaker was associate editor of the Harvard Conservative when it was being published earlier in the 60s. His field is the sciences. He was a graduate in chemistry and physics and is now working on his doctorate in theoretical physics. His writing, however, will be familiar to many of you in the Rally and New Guard, places of that sort. He's also published in National Review, Verse, I understand, and in the Intercollegiate Review. It's with considerable pleasure that I introduce to you Mr. David Friedman.
I enjoyed Gary's presentation. I'm almost tempted to junk the speech I was going to give and spend my time trying to refute him, but I think I'll limit myself to a few comments in that direction and then go on to what I had to say. To start with, he seemed through a large part of his talk to be confusing the terms chaos and anarchy, in spite of the fact that he later seemed to recognize that most modern anarchists, and I think all of the historical anarchists that I have heard of, assume that an anarchist society would also have stable institutions, pattern, order of various sorts, merely not the state. Also, he seemed to be arguing that man could not be entirely sovereign over himself, for various reasons having to do with man's lack of perfectibility. So far as I know, the state is the assertion that certain men should be sovereign over others. And it would seem to me that this is even less justified given imperfect man. One last comment on the things he said. A particularly amusing example of the argument that certain things should not be done efficiently comes from that anarchist par excellence, Murray Rothbard, who has argued that inasmuch as he is against American imperialism and thinks that the American army is, and Air Force and Navy and so forth are doing bad things, therefore he would support the nationalization of defense industries, inasmuch as they would make them less efficient, since we all know that socialism is an inefficient way of doing things. Now, if I can get back to what I was planning to talk about. We're supposed to be talking about lessons of the past. I hope you won't mind if I mingle in some lessons of or for the future. Professor Hayek, who has been mentioned here already in a fairly well-known essay, argued that one of the reasons for the success of socialists in this century was that they had the courage to be utopian, that they were willing not only to propose immediate measures to, as they saw it, improve the world, but also that they were willing to put up a vision of how the world could and should be, and that men are more willing to struggle, more willing to act, when they know where they are going, even if they do not really expect to get there. I think a large part of the significance of the new libertarianism, or of libertarian anarchy, or whatever you wish to call it, is an attempt by some of us to imitate that strategy of the socialists, to build for ourselves a model of what a really satisfactory society would be, in that sense, to build a utopia. Now, when I speak of a utopia, I don't mean something which requires perfect man to live in it. I mean only a society which none of us expect to achieve in the near future, but which we imagine is not by its nature unachievable, just as the democratic socialists had a vision of a society which they believed was consistent with the nature of man, but could not be built overnight. So that the utopia, so to speak, which I will describe, is open to the criticisms of those who argue that because people aren't completely rational, something or other will follow. And those of us who defend that as a valid utopia must be willing to defend it against such criticisms. So what I will be talking about, then, is the question of ultimately where we are going, what our utopia is, and the question of how to get there. I recognize that some people in this room may feel that there is a grave danger haunting us that we may perchance, by one careless step, immanentize an eschaton and thereupon perish. I can say only that we recognize this danger and are prepared, armed with appropriate buttons, to confront and avoid the Gnostic menace as it presents itself on our particular problems. It might even be argued that several of the particular personalities in the libertarian movement, for instance, those who argue that essentially all property has been stolen from someone, so we should take it away from them and give it to the poor blacks, have already suffered something of a Gnostic breakdown. However, I'll try to avoid any specific argument with other positions in the libertarian movement. Obviously, libertarians, above all other people, are not unanimous about anything. And I think the position I am describing represents, in some sense, the mainstream of libertarian anarchy or anarcho-capitalism or whatever you want to call it, although there are certainly some people who would disagree with it. To start out with, what do I mean by anarchy? What do I mean when I sometimes call myself an anarchist? I certainly do not mean that I want to live in a society which has no institutions to keep people from stealing from me. I do mean that ideally, ultimately, I would like to live in a society which does not have a state. What I mean by the state is an institution of legitimized coercion. That is to say, an institution which claims special rights for itself, above and beyond the rights which private individuals have, and whose claim is in some sense accepted by a large part of the population. Thus, for instance, a criminal is not a state, since although he engages in coercion, it is not legitimized. Nobody around him thinks he has the right to do it. On the other hand, when the tax collector comes to my door a week or so from now and says, you may either give me your money or be put in jail, a sort of modern version of your money or your life, most of my neighbors would think it odd if I tried to call the police. Therefore, the state engaged in the same act for which the robber would be condemned is considered by most of the society in some sense legitimate. And therefore, I define the state as an agency of legitimized coercion. And I'm interested in asking the question, can one plausibly describe an attractive society which does not require inhuman perfection of its members, in which there were no such agency of legitimized coercion? And I think the answer is you can. Under certain circumstances, such a society might be stable. Under certain other circumstances, it might not be, just as a limited state might or may not be stable. One thing that Murray Rothbard has said, which I think is a legitimate point, is that after all, we are accused of being hopeless romantics, utopians for proposing a workable anarchic society. But when was the last time you saw a limited state that stayed limited? That it can be equally well argued that the proposal of a limited state is a utopian notion, one which never has existed and by the dynamics of the state never can exist. That was a digression which I really shouldn't have gotten onto. So the question is then, how could what we think of as the minimal functions of the minimal state be replaced by private institutions? And those minimal functions are usually described as courts, police protection, and defense. For Mises, it's defined as courts, police, protection, defense, and the national opera. However, not being a disciple of von Mises, I am not obliged to explain how my anarchy will provide the national opera. I will discuss those 3 points in the order of the easiest first. So start with the problem of how one can have a functioning court system without government. And to discuss the easiest part of that problem, discuss the problem of civil courts enforcing contracts. Now here it's a relatively simple problem, and in fact there presently exist, in effect, private courts, such as the American Arbitration Association, which are in the business of enforcing contracts. What happens is two firms wish to make a contract. They want some way of arbitrating disputes among themselves. And so in the contract, they specify who will arbitrate disputes. Now, under present institutions, the main enforcement procedure is simply reputation. In fact, I think it's arguable that in the entire civil court system of the country, insofar as it concerns established businesses, is superfluous. That is to say that the force of businesses wishing to maintain a reputation for honesty is in itself sufficient. I could give some examples of that. For instance, we've done a little experiment on the subject in Chicago. Those of you acquainted with scientific method know that the usual way of experimenting on the effect of something is to look at circumstances with the thing and then take it away. Well, as you may know, the civil courts in Chicago are about 4 or 5 years behind at the moment, and therefore have very little effect on any legal question except those so major that someone is willing to spend 5 years waiting for a result. So far as I know, commercial honesty is not declined in the city of Chicago as a result of this, and it therefore appears that in this particular case, the courts are, in a sense, superfluous, that the main reason that most stores don't cheat their customers is because they wouldn't have any customers if they did, not because they're afraid of being dragged into court. I would argue that if one did not have government enforcement mechanisms, such civil contracts as involve contracts between established institutions could all be handled by non-governmental courts. That the cost to an institution of having a reputation for refusing to abide by its contracts would be sufficiently high to prevent it from refusing to follow the court's arbitration. In addition, in those cases of, for instance, new firms which didn't have a reputation, the court could arrange to have the firms deposit sums of money with the court, which the court could then use to award damages to somebody who won a suit. So that I think the problem of civil cases in which there's a pre-existing contract is not a serious one, that one can easily enough see how the market would establish institutions to deal with those. Some of you may be familiar with a very interesting book by Robert Heinlein called The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, in which he describes essentially a functioning anarchist society. And the narrator, who has grown up in this society, visits Earth and comes back, and he's really amazed by Earth. Why, he says, on Earth they have laws for everything. They even have laws for private contracts. Why would you do business with a man if you couldn't trust his word? And of course he's right. In such a society you wouldn't. And such a society would evolve appropriate mechanisms for conveying information, for telling you what someone's reputation was, and so forth. Now, I've dealt so far with the easiest problem of all, namely courts with pre-existing contracts. In order to discuss the problem of criminal courts, we have to get into the problem of how a free society could provide police protection. The way it would do that would be to sell protection on the market like any other economic good. That is, you have a firm, call it Tannehelp Incorporated, which is in the business of insuring its customers against losses from criminal acts and preventing it from having to pay off on that insurance by protecting the customers from those criminal acts. Now, the first problem that arises is people say, well, what about wars? That is to say, I believe that Gary has stolen something from me. I report it to my Tannehelp agent. He comes and examines the equipment that he installed in my house when I signed the contract, which includes an automatic camera or similar devices. He takes whatever detective methods he considers necessary and determines that Gary is indeed the criminal. And he goes to Gary and says, look, you've stolen $200 from David. Give it back. And
I'm innocent.
And Gary says, not only am I innocent, but I've just signed a contract of my own with Dawn Defense. And if you come and try to take that $200 away, Dawn Defense will treat me as the injured party and will defend me. Aha, then we have a war. Terrible results. But let's see what actually happens, assuming that these companies are run by good profit-making businessmen. The Tannehelp agent writes to Dawn Defense and says, "Dear sirs, we have reason to believe that one of your clients has stolen some goods from one of our clients. Now, we could try to reclaim these goods by force. However, if we did that, that would engage us in a war with you. You know, and we know, that if we fight a war with you, it'll be very expensive. We'll have to raise the salary of our people because they'll take those at risk of getting killed. We'll have to use up lots of expensive machinery, tanks and so forth, whatever we fight the war with. And you know what's going to happen then? You and I will both have to raise our rates. And you know what's going to happen then? MAL, a third protective agency, has already been poaching on our territory. And if you and I have to raise our rates, they're going to take all our customers away and we'll be out of business. So look, instead of fighting a war, let's arbitrate it. Let's go to, here's a list of arbitration firms who have a good reputation for being honest, God-fearing folk. We'll agree that we'll arbitrate the matter, and if Gary is found innocent, then we'll pay you an agreed-upon sum for your time and trouble, and if he's found guilty, then he'll turn over the $200 plus compensation for our time and trouble to us, and you'll agree not to protect him if he doesn't turn it over. And clearly it's in the interest of the other protective agency to agree to such an arbitration agreement. In fact, once the system is established, it will be in the interest of all of the protection agencies to have pre-existing contracts with each other, so that between each pair of protection agencies, there's an agreement that disputes among their clients will be arbitrated by a pre-chosen arbitrator. Such pre-existing contracts get rid of some of the obvious objections to this scheme. For instance, people will say, suppose some of the private courts follow one set of law, some a different set of law. I want the court which I know will decide my way. You want the court that you know will decide your way. Well, the answer to this is that since the protective agencies are signing a long-run agreement with each other for who will arbitrate, they don't know in advance whether their clients will be on one side of the legal decision or the other. And therefore, what they want is that legal system which in some average sense produces the best results at the lowest cost without 5-year waiting periods and so forth. Clearly, under such an institution, what would happen if there were one protective agency that was very unreasonable and didn't accept arbitration? It would be constantly fighting wars with its neighbors. Its neighbors would be only very sporadically fighting wars only when they ran into it. Therefore, its costs would be much higher than its competitors' costs, and it would be driven out of business. So that's, I think, the answer to the first objection, the objection which I think Ayn Rand makes against the possibility of competing governments. The second objection that is made, which I think is more serious, is the danger of a coup. Suppose these protective agencies decide that, you know, business is business and it's very profitable, but stealing is even more profitable, let's become a state. Well, of course, the first answer to that is, in that case, we're only back where we are now. I mean, that, after all, is what the federal government is doing. It's stealing a couple hundred billion a year from all of us. But you could argue, better the devil we know than the devil we don't know. At least it's only $300 billion a year. It could be $500 billion a year. I would argue that there are reasons why such a coup, although not impossible, is unlikely. In particular, it's unlikely unless economies of scale and police protection are very large. That is, if you end up with only one private protection agency providing services to anybody, then you've got a problem, because that protection agency is in a position to impose its will, stealing from the rest of us, and then I would say the only defense is an armed populace, which I'm in favor of anyway. Now, assume, though, what I hope would be the case, and I think would be the case, that it would turn out the economies of scale were not that great, and that the optimal size for a protective agency was perhaps 100,000 clients, 1 million clients, some number such that there were some hundreds of protection agencies. Now, if any one protection agency tries to start stealing from its clients will, of course, hire another protection agency and be willing to pay a very high price to get out from under this monster in order to defend them against it. Therefore, you have to, for a coup, have virtually all of the protective agencies at once get together into some sort of a state conspiracy. I would argue that the people who are in protective agencies are much less likely to do that sort of thing than the people in the present government. That is to say, as Hayek pointed out in Road to Serfdom, the rulers in a governmental system are selected for rather unpleasant characteristics, such as liking to stab other people in the back, liking to control other people, liking to get unearned benefits, and so forth. Assuming that you at one time have a functioning protective agency system, the heads of those agencies will be businessmen. They are men who are selected for the characteristic of providing a good service at a low price, satisfying their customers, and so forth. Therefore, in order to have the coup, you require that by some accident, hundreds of power-seeking people, hundreds of the sort of people who now get into government, come to the top of these hundreds of private corporations all at once. And I would argue that in general, these people will be eliminated at a very low level. That short of being the head of a government, a man whose idea of good business is using force to steal from his customers will either be eliminated from his protective agency by his superiors or eliminated with his protection agency when it goes bankrupt. And that therefore the sort of market protection agency system I'm describing does have its own built-in protection against the sort of coup that I'm discussing. Now you have to remember when you say, well, but the protection agencies will have all the guns. The government at the moment has all the guns, or too damn many of them anyway. And trying to cut down the number the rest of us have as quickly as possible. And therefore, it clearly is possible for institutions to prevent people with guns from stealing everything you've got, because that's happening now. They're only stealing about a third of what we've got. And therefore, it's not intrinsically implausible that the sort of market mechanism I'm describing would also suffice to prevent people from stealing, hopefully to prevent the protection agencies from stealing anything. All right, so I've discussed how the criminal courts would work, that is, by contracts among the protective agency, how the civil courts would work, and how the police protection would be provided. In addition, I should say another way of providing police protection would be proprietary communities. That is to say, a developer buys up a piece of land, builds a wall around it, subdivides it, builds houses, and says, anybody who comes to live here has to sign a contract agreeing to pay a certain amount in taxes, to have a democratic or dictatorial or whatever ever form of government, and to arrange any other mutually agreeable arrangements. That would be another way within such a free society of providing police protection, voluntary small states, in effect. Now, the hardest problem of all to do without the state is protection against foreign states. And I think a lot of anarchists make the mistake of thinking that there is some simple solution to this problem. For instance, Carl Hess implicitly argues that we can fight them village by village, and that each local group of people can fight off the invaders by themselves. And I think he's underestimating the effectiveness of a tactic of saying, well, the last village that fought us, we dropped an A-bomb on. How would you like to pay some tribute? So I don't think this is workable. I think it is an unfortunate fact of the present state of technology that you have to have national defense in some sense. One of the typical verbal tricks that people like Carl use is to say, we don't need national defense because we don't have a nation. But the trouble with that is you've still got things that other people want to steal, and you still have states that would like to steal them. And I think it is true that the state of Illinois probably can't defend itself very effectively against the Soviet Union, and that therefore protection has got to be done on a national level. And here, of course, you run into the old holdout problem. That is to say, if you're buying a social good, if one thing has to be bought for a whole lot of people or not bought at all, what do you do about the guy who says, well, you're paying for it anyway, why should I pay for it? As you may know, there's a very elegant theoretical solution to this problem, which unfortunately doesn't apply very well for large societies. The way it works is you figure out how much the good is worth to every single person in the society, each one a different price. You then draw up this gigantic contract saying, I, John Smith, agree to pay $300, Mr. Jones pay $250, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and the contract only goes into effect if it's unanimously signed. Then you pass it around, and each potential holdout says, if everybody else signs it and I don't, I won't get the product which is worth this price to me. If anybody else doesn't sign it, then I don't get it whether I sign or not. so it's in my interest to sign it. If you sort of think it out as a game theory strategy, it's a perfectly valid strategy. There's only one problem. That problem is that if you misestimated one person's price, you don't get the contract. If Mr. Jones, unknown to you, is a secret communist agent, and you say, we have to have your signature on the unanimous contract, your price is $300, and he says, well, I don't think it's worth $300, sorry about that, then you don't have any defense. So therefore, although this solution is very elegant in theory, it breaks down due to incomplete knowledge. So I think it is true that there is no non-coercive mechanism, no free market mechanism, by which you can get from the society the entire value to the society of being defended. Therefore, you could have a situation in which the total social value to the society of being defended was, say, $100 billion, and yet you could not raise the money to buy a $90 billion defense system. This does not necessarily mean you won't be defended. That depends on how big the difference is between the value to the people of being defended and the cost of doing it. Suppose, for instance, that the social value to people of being defended was $100 billion and the cost of defense was only $5 billion. In that case, it's quite likely that some approximate scheme, charity, selling passports, going to certain isolated areas and saying to the insurance companies insuring property there, we won't defend you unless you fork over such and such an amount, could raise a sufficient sum. Now, this may sound very unlikely when I talk, for instance, about supporting the national defense by charity. If you do the calculations of what a isolationist foreign policy would cost, that is, what the cost to the U.S. of those parts of its defense, which are really defensive, missiles, army in the U.S. and so forth are, it turns out to something of the order of $100 per capita. And I don't think it's at all impossible that under some circumstances you could raise that sort of sum by the kind of approximate means, charity, selling passports or whatever, that I'm suggesting. I would suggest, of course, as I'll say in this discussion of how we get to such a society, that this would be the last thing you would take the government out of, and that you would want to get the government out of national defense only after it was clear that you were going to be able to provide national defense in other ways. Remember, when I discussed what I meant by a utopia, I said I do not mean something which requires perfect men, but I do mean something which, although it may be achievable, also may not at a particular time. It'll depend on various circumstances whether this utopia is or is not stable. And therefore, it would depend partly on how rich the society was, how much people were willing to give money to charity, how much its technological lead was over socialist states, and so forth. One of the advantages, of course, is that we all believe that if we got rid of the other 90% of government, we'd be an awful lot richer. And therefore, the percentage of our income it would take to raise that $100 per capita would be much less. All right, I think that I've finished discussing in a very brief and outline fashion what the anarchist utopia is, and what those of us who call ourselves anarcho-capitalists or libertarian anarchists mean by that. Now I'd like to discuss how we get there, that is, what is an appropriate strategy for achieving such a completely free market society. I would argue that in spite of the noise made by a few anarcho-capitalists, the principal position is a very much a non-revolutionary, even an anti-revolutionary strategy. There are two good reasons for this, which I think are accepted by most of the people I've run into who call themselves right-wing anarchists. The first reason is that a state exists because people think it's necessary, whether or not they're right. And that therefore, even if it's true that private individuals could run a perfect society with everybody rich and the Russians kept far away and everything else without the government, as long as 99% of the population believes they need the government to run the post office and the army and everything else, if you abolish the government today, it will be rebuilt tomorrow, and it might be worse. In any case, your effort would all have been wasted. So that from that standpoint, the strategy has to be to obsolete the state first and abolish it later. It has to be a strategy of first demonstrating that alternative institutions can do the things the state is now doing. And then, as each state activity is being done better by something else, say, all right, then what the hell do we have to pay taxes to the government to do this for? And that if one reached the point where, for instance, everybody was voting down taxes for police because private protection agencies were, in fact, protecting them, and in which the courts had nobody going to the courts because private courts were doing a better job of arbitrating, then people would be perfectly willing to let these institutions just fade away. So that's the first argument for the policy which I describe as selling the state. I use this phrase partly because a few people are fond of the slogan, smash the state. And I always argue that the state is this peculiar thing which if you smash it, it'll always come back. And therefore, the only way to get rid of it is not to smash it, but to sell it piece by piece. Now, there's a second argument against revolution. This is an argument which has been, I think, best stated recently by a gentleman by the name of Sky Dorius, who is a sort of a mad genius on the West Coast. I don't know if a few of you have probably met him. He's very colorful. He's sort of a hippie type, acid head or ex-acid head, was an MIT student. He's got a very high IQ and a very, very creative and sort of strange kind of mind, and half of what he says is crazy and half of it is very good. And he likes to analyze economics in terms of cybernetics, in terms of control mechanisms. And the way he puts the argument, it's an argument many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with, is that economic institutions have as their error signal profit. That is, they find out whether they're doing a good job by whether people like what they're producing and buy their product. Political mechanisms have as their error signal power. That is to say, they find out whether they're doing a good job by whether they're in office, by whether they're in a position to impose their will on people. A revolutionary organization is by its nature a political mechanism. A revolutionary cadre, a revolutionary conspiracy, is an organization which seeks power, whose error signal is power, which therefore will end up taking power if it can. And that therefore, Sky would argue, and I would agree, that if one somehow set up a conspiracy of anarchists and used that to somehow destroy the government, by the time you finish doing that, the people who would be running that conspiracy would themselves be your next generation of dictators. Now, this point, I think, is made very effectively in much of Heinlein's writing. I should say in passing that those of you who have not read Heinlein should. He is probably the best science fiction writer alive, as well as the most popular. He is himself a right-wing anarchist, I would say, a friend of Lefebvre's. He is also, and rather strangely, popular with the hippies. He supported Goldwater in 64. He's all in favor of capitalism. And he is a very intelligent man who, in a sense, in the same sense that I am, is a sort of an anarchist traditionalist. That is to say, he recognizes that human beings function within traditions, and that so would a working anarchist society. And that in order to have a working anarchist society, you would have to build those institutions and those traditions that would make it function. And the interesting thing about his latest book, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, is that he describes how a set of people, placed under circumstances where they had to get along without a state or die, those ones who didn't die succeeded in working out ways of getting along without the state. But that was a digression, too. I start digressing when I talk about Heinlein because I like him so much. Okay. Robert A. Heinlein, H-E-I-N-L-E-I-N. But one of the recurrent themes throughout his books is the danger of the revolutionary organization taking power. One of his earlier novels describes a successful revolution against a theocracy. The theocracy is a far future theocracy, and it maintains its power largely by psychological means, by sort of brainwashing. And just after the revolution has succeeded, but when there's still a considerable degree of uncertainty as to whether or not the revolution will finally succeed or whether there'll be a counter-revolution, there's a big meeting of the people who are in this conspiracy at attack on the spot in the middle of his oratory, and they reject it. But if you look at all of Heinlein's writing, I shouldn't say all, he's written about a lot of other things too, but maybe half a dozen different books or stories come back to this problem of how you can overthrow an oppressive government without becoming an oppressive government. And I would argue that it's because of this problem that any path towards eliminating the government must be non-political in the sense of not involving setting up its own political mechanism. Indeed, I would argue that even to the extent of saying that I think it is unfortunate that YAF is political in the sense of electing people, that I think, analyzing what happened this summer, that part of it was implicit in the structure of the organization, that within the structure of the organization, if anybody starts building up a following around a philosophical belief, he is potentially a political threat to whoever controls the organization. And you therefore get fights which are philosophically unnecessary but caused by the fact that the organization internally is a political organization with elections and conventions and the rest of it. And one of the things that makes me optimistic for the future of the libertarian movement is that the new organizations, which some of the people who left YAF have been setting up, are not political. That SIL, for instance, is the private property of four people who hope to make money out of it. And they are engaged not only in selling the state, but in trying to sell the state at a profit. They are selling various services, organization, pamphlets, and so forth. In fact, the best statement of the present libertarian strategy that I've heard comes from a man of whose politics I know very little else, except that a lot of people seem to dislike him. The statement is, if this country is worth saving, it's worth saving at a profit. And the speaker is H.L. Hunt, who I think knows of what he speaks. So I would argue, and I think most, although not all, of the present anarcho-capitalists would argue, that the proper strategy really involves two lines. It involves, on the one hand, persuading people to get rid of the government in certain areas, to allow private people to compete. For instance, persuading people to pass things like tuition voucher plans, which probably most of you are familiar with. Persuading people to lift the monopoly protection on the post office, and thus allowing private enterprises to replace the state and therefore demonstrate the state is unnecessary. That's one strategy. The other line of strategy is to ignore the state and build private institutions yourself that obsolete it. For instance, build firms which sell some form of protection from criminal activity, whether by sophisticated burglar alarms, insurance, fortified suburbs, or whatever. That is actually happening, as some of you may know. People are, private developers are now developing suburbs with security systems coming in and out. And that's one solution. That's essentially a proprietary community. There are various schemes in the air at the moment, all of which involve either selling protection from the state or selling protection in competition with the state. These things are conceived of as profit-making enterprises, and therefore I don't feel free to discuss in too much detail what they are, because the people who are doing them, I'm not making any profit out of them. I'm not a businessman. But the people who are doing them feel that there's a certain element of confidentiality to the details of their plans. If you want to discuss getting in on them, I can give you names of people to talk to. But the general idea, as I say, is either to create alternative institutions, to create ways of doing the things the state does and should do better and cheaper, at the same time to persuade people to reduce the power of the state. And this, I would say, is the main thrust of anarcho-capitalism as it presently exists. And I think, in some sense, the correct strategy to follow. Now, I'm not sure. I think I've really said everything that I wanted to say. I'd like to take questions if that is consistent with the...
We'll wait till the end.
Till the end? All right. Fine. And I'll be glad to argue out any of this with my friend on my left, who believes that men are not sufficiently virtuous to be sovereign over themselves, but are sufficiently virtuous to be sovereign over each other. I should say, the left has the slogan, all power to the people, and I prefer to alter that very slightly into all power to the persons.